This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism, hashtag podcast, hashtag broad on Joy 94.9.
We should also not forget that patriarchy has only been here for 6,000 years, which in the scheme of things, how long the planet has existed, is actually a very short time, so we can overthrow it. And patriarchy, we've always, radical feminism has always characterized as being not just sexism, but classism and racism and, you know, being against disabled, discriminating against disabled people and you name it. So it's not just that, you know, men discriminate against women on the grounds of sex. It's all the other issues. It's what these days is called intersectional.
Where a feminist press publishing controversial and innovative feminist books with an optimistic edge. And we felt that we needed to do something like have that extra bit about optimism because we both felt, well, why would you bother being a feminist if you didn't have some sort of optimism about changing
and
the world
future
and the possibility for change?
Broad.
On Joy 94.9. This is Sonia. This is Broad on Joy 94.9. And we're talking about That's Radical Feminism. It's a celebration of Spinifex 25 years. This is a publishing house, a very rare and interesting creation house, stable. And it's, yeah, it's being run by, well, pretty much by two fantastic woman for a long time. I take it 25 years, obviously. And we have in the studio talking to us, we've got Susan Hawthorne and Renata Klein. Welcome.
Thanks, Sonia.
Thank you. Okay, so let's get started. Let's talk about this wonderful event. After 25 years, this is the first time you've put together a couple of days of festival?
No, 10 years ago, when we turned 15, we had a two-day celebration.
Okay.
That was 2006, and we, in the past, you know, we've both organised big events: the International Feminist Book Fair and the Australian Feminist Book Fortnight. And I did a conference back in 1985 called "The Language of Difference," which went for 9 days. Only a first-timer would agree to doing that.
9 days, wouldn't it? I don't think we survived that.
I don't think anyone does 9 days anymore.
Well, they do, actually. Melbourne Writers' Festival does, too.
Yes,
they're obviously copying us.
Oh, of course, yeah. Nothing's original, really. Wow, 9 days, though. That's a huge undertaking.
Well, by about the sixth day, you get a second wind. You know,
you haven't collapsed.
You had some pretty famous writers there.
Yeah, well, Kerry Hume came for it. Audre Lorde. And lots of writers from all over Australia. And
Is there a record of any video?
There's a book that I edited at the time called "The Language," called "Difference: Writings by Women." And at the Melbourne University Archives, there's a whole archive of photos and information about it. So, yeah,
cool.
It's still there.
It still exists. That's fantastic. Well, of course, we are going to talk about That's Radical Feminism. This is the 2 day of inspiration, as it's described. I'm just reading this now. Cheating, of course. But let's talk about Spinifex and what is it for those of our listeners who don't know.
Spinifex is a writer-run radical feminist press. We set up in 1991. Both Renata and I co-founded Spinifex. And we set it up so that we could publish books. We Erratic Feminist Books, we didn't think that we would last for more than a year.
Really? Really?
No.
Well, yeah. We sort of thought, let's do it for a year and experiment. Yeah. And here we are. We're still here 25 years later.
Wow. Still experimenting.
Yes. And our mission statement that we wrote back then is that we're a feminist press publishing controversial and innovative feminist books with an optimistic edge. And we felt that we needed to do something like have that extra bit about optimism, because we both felt, well, why would you bother being a feminist if you didn't have some sort of optimism about changing
and
the world
future
and the possibility for change.
Mm. And we did it because at the time Susan was working at Penguin and I was teaching women's studies at Deakin University.
Oh, cool.
And I've been a critic of reproductive technologies for a very long time, and I kind of felt that my our writing didn't really get through anymore to some audiences who just thought, oh, Klein is just writing the same stuff again, you know. And so I was the more non-fiction person, you were the fiction person, so we put our talents together. And our first book was called Angels of Power, which took its name from a play that Sandra Shortlander wrote. And it was a wonderful, it is actually, I should say, not just was, it is a wonderful collection on writings, critical writings on reproductive technology, exploring such topical issues as surrogacy. Nothing ever goes away. And one of my critics, who had previously said, oh, Klein again, said, oh, Klein can put together a book that's actually very readable.
I guess so, that's a compliment.
And the book sold out really quickly, and we thought, wow, that's fantastic. That's easy to be a publisher. Mm. Let's reprint. And only after we reprinted, we realized we actually hadn't been paid by bookshops. And so we thought, how strange is that? And so we rang them and we found out that they pay first Penguin and then HarperCollins and then Ushet and then down the ways.
And then you end up with 30 cents.
And so we made lots of mistakes in the first year. Because
Not just the first year.
Well, no.
No, we
24 years. No.
We continued to make. I mean, that's the thing about books. Every book is different. Yeah. Every book that goes through the production process somehow is different. You get better at it and you get to the point where you you kind of know what to expect and the timelines and things like that. But sometimes unexpected things happen, and you know, that's just how it is. And it's amazing that books are as cheap as they are. There's so many people put their minds to it,
and
put
it's so
much
evolving,
work into
isn't it?
It's a little cottage industry in lots of ways. So I actually, you know, I mean, most books cost not more than what most people spend if they go out to a bar or to have a meal or go to the pictures or something like that. So, you know,
or less these days.
And then you've got the book for the rest of your life if you want.
Yeah, exactly.
And that also, that perhaps leads into the fact that we started to do e-books very early on. We were the third publisher in Australia to start doing e-books in 2006. We've continued to do that because everybody does it anyway. And sometimes, you know, people said, oh, e-books should be free. And they don't understand that an e-book is based on a published book. So you have the same process. You get a manuscript, then you have to look at it first, read it, decide whether you want to do it. Then you have to edit it. And every good book really needs to be edited three times. Then you have to have a cover. So you talk to the designer. It all costs money. Then you still have to produce a typeset copy, because you can't have an e-book without a typeset copy. So people don't understand that actually an e-book is nothing but an electronic version of a book that has gone through its usual stages of production.
There are additional costs, namely trying to figure out, trying to pay for the contracts that you need to sign. And because the contracts that you get for e-books, mostly US-based, and are really complicated and different from any other contract you've ever seen, that you have to talk to a lawyer.
And that costs
now, lawyers
a
cost
lot.
Money. So actually you've got an additional cost on top of the usual cost for a print book. So e-books are even ridiculously cheap.
And then sometimes we have really funny moments when we get an email from some of these big companies and they say, perhaps your IT department could deal with this request.
It's us. There are five of us.
Five of us. We all muddle through it. Some people have really gotten themselves a lot of expertise in digital publishing, but we do not have an IT department. So it's quite fun. It's funny, but it's also sometimes very frustrating.
It's a constant learning curve because, of course, that came, even after 15 years of being in publishing, we got this huge new learning.
Yes. It's changing so much all the time. And, of course, people want access at any, at a minimum cost to them, applications on iPhones and tablets and so on and so on. And, it must be really tough to, as the size that you are, which is the five of you, to handle this.
Well,
we do go with the trends.
We've got e-books. Most of our books are available as e-books as well.
Mm. On all these different devices. Mm.
And, of course, I must add that, as you said to me off air, 205 books that are still published now.
That are in print.
That's the word.
That's one of our
in print.
Our philosophies is to keep our books in print.
Mm. Mm.
And often, with bigger publishers, they can be out of print within 12 months and you never see them again.
that is quite sad.
Part of our rationale for doing that is that because we're a feminist publisher, we tend to be ahead of the cultural curve.
Mm.
So we are somewhere between 10 and 25 years ahead of the cultural curve so far. And
so this is really your first birthday.
Well, in a way. it is that there are books that we published in our first couple of years that now the media is just starting to talk about.
And, of course, recognise it. And, of course, probably universities are using as well.
Well, they've forgotten actually that we did it.
Oh, right.
that's the difficult thing. And that's one of the reasons for producing our complete catalogue.
Mm, it's a great idea.
So that readers can go through the entire catalogue, see what they might have missed out on, and get it or order it or
and send they can it see where where it's come from, and to know that it's in print.
Mm.
Is really, really special.
And we, at the moment, one of the big buzzwords seems to be diversity. Mm. And, we've done diversity from the word go, but we did a little bit of Susan did a diversity survey of our books. What did you find?
I found that, first of all of the books nearly all of the books that we publish are by women. So that
I'd say the word mandate, but is that something that you've always been, strong and firm about?
Well, because actually there are many publishers out there who only publish men.
Mm.
They don't say that.
They don't say it, but
they just
the way it is,
Or they publish maybe 10% of their books might be by women. So we think we need to go the other way. So that gives us a bit of an advantage in the diversity
stakes.
Mm. But as well as that, we discovered that of that, around about 80% of what we publish could count as diversity in the buzzword sense that it's now used. So that includes Indigenous writers, it includes lesbians and people who've migrated to Australia, women who speak a different language, women with disabilities, very young and very old writers. We publish the entire gamut of that spectrum.
Mm.
And about 45% of the books that we publish are by lesbians. We were surprised. We thought that actually we might have published more lesbians than heterosexuals, but nope, even when you try, it's really hard. However,
where are they all?
I still think that we probably publish more lesbian writers than anybody else. It is.
Actually,
published specific books about class and about climate change, you know, all of the violence against women, all of the important issues. I mean, we
that
have
are relevant
pretty
now.
Much yeah. covered.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like it's really interesting because it's like you've done the work, the hard yards, as the Americans call it, sowing those seeds. And when you do flick through this amazing catalogue, the anniversary catalogue of Spinifex Press, you just see all those titles and information there, right there. And it's just incredible.
And there's been incredible. Over the Melbourne Writers Festival, there's been quite a focus on writers from Asia. And we've published something like 28 titles by Asian writers at some point. And, you know, that's a significant,
that's a big,
10%, more than 10% of our publishing output.
And including Asian lesbians as
including
well, including
lesbians
well known.
From Japan and India, from Turkey.
Fantastic.
A book by a Vietnamese writer, Australian writer about lesbians, a Palestinian writer, as well as Indigenous writers from Australia, Aotearoa, and North America as well. So, you know, as well as writers from Botswana and Nigeria and, you know, places where most people haven't actually read the literature for.
Yes, and we realized early on that we had to go international. We wouldn't have survived if we had stayed within the Australian market. It's just not big enough. And at the time, 1991, there was still a very, very very vibrant feminist publishing industry in the States. So we would go to exhibitions, to
book fairs
in New York, and there'd be a whole aisle of gay and lesbian books and feminist publishers and booksellers. And then, unfortunately, Borders came in, you know, the bookstore, and ordered enormous masses of feminist books in the first instance, so the feminist bookstores couldn't, and sold them cheaper, so the feminist bookstores couldn't compete anymore. And so a lot of them really closed down, and that had, of course, a trigger effect on the feminist publishers.
Of course.
And by that time, Borders thought, no, they don't need to order so many books. So they sent them back, and then all what happened to us with Angels of Power, you know, we got some books sent back, and all of a sudden you have already reprinted and you get a lot of books sent back by bookstores, because that's something that few people actually know. If a bookstore orders, let's say, 20 copies of a book and they sell 5, they have the right to return the other 15. Now, I can't think of another industry where that's happening as well. I mean, there may well be some, but it's incredible that the book industry allows that to happen, and very few people actually really know about that.
So, and the effects that would have on women writers must have been... It's a travesty, it really is, because I was looking at some recent information that's come through just in the last couple of days. I went to the United Nations forum about economic empowerment and girls, women and girls, and the economic plight in the world is an issue, lots of different issues there. And they put up a slide about the largest area for women in media is publishing, but fiction writing.
Right.
And women are like 73%, huge chunk. But from that, as far as economic independence, it's terrible. It's just the other way. It's still the male publishers, still the male stories. But yet the woman's story, or woman writers, are the most prolific.
Yeah. When I worked at Penguin, it's really disturbing. And I was there in the late 80s, I did a count of the women who were being published in 1988. Right. And at that time, we had one male author of Penguin who was writing in and saying, "Oh, you know, all you can't get published as a man anymore. All you ever publish is women." So that prompted me to count it. And I was the editor of a series called the Penguin Australian Women's Library. So that was a specialist series of books where there were about 4 books a year that were being published. It was, the series editor was Dale Spender. And even with those extra 4 to 6 books a year, the numbers of women being published at that time was never over 40%, never. So men had this perception.
Yep. Because they saw the names and it seemed visible.
Because it had gone up from 10% or 20% to 40%. that you know, that it wasn't possible to get published anymore. You know.
I think that hasn't changed, actually.
I don't think it's changed very much.
Many men, not all, thank God, but many men are so threatened, feel so threatened by feminists of all kinds that they kind of just see us like, you know, a beast with three horns, and they immediately think that we're going to take the world over.
I think they've done studies on that. Something like if one out of three women, I would say, promoted in a bit, say it's a corporate business, the men start to get up when goes the ankles, and you know,
and you see it in advertising. You know, we have five people in an ad, and frequently there'll be a woman of colour. And then there'll be four men, or there'll be two women and three men, and that is considered equality. You know, like it isn't. It's still 60% to 40%.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Two women. And it's the same with particularly in broadcasting and in television media. It's just mind-boggling, terrible. I mean, you know, it's like you've got two guys and one woman. Or if you see a lot of the posters around for radio broadcasters, it's one woman and two guys, or it's just all men for everything. Yes. So they like to have their one representative, someone that is often someone, not always, but someone who is perhaps more pliable, I suppose, or more manageable, if that's the right word. And that's a terrible thing to say about any woman in those positions. But it seems to be the case.
And then the horrible horrible defense that she got from some people, some mostly men, but I think some women too, say, well, it really wasn't that bad. I mean, holding her under the water, cold water, the old witch trick, you know, if the witch comes up, then she's innocent.
If she drowns, she's innocent, and if she floats and survives, she's guilty, so then she will be burnt.
That's disgraceful. What year is it? I get confused.
That's a really good question. We ask that often. What is it? It's 2016.
Yeah.
And I mean, like when Trudeau came in as Prime Minister in Canada, and I don't really know how well he's doing, but he seems to be the favourite boy at the moment.
He's very popular.
And when he appointed 50% of his cabinet as women, and he was asked, he said, well, because it's 2015. And look at us. Look at us.
I know. It's embarrassing. It really is. Very embarrassing. But thankfully, there's people can, you know, find out a lot about feminism through the books that you've got. And that brings me to your own work. We should talk about that. I mean, we've been talking about the publishing and how difficult it is and the challenges and things like that in the last 25 years. But you yourself, you've written clearly a lot.
Well, I'm a poet, and I think I became a poet because I didn't have time to write novels anymore.
Oh, okay. And you thought poetry would be easier?
No, it's not easier. In fact, I still think I'm learning.
Yeah.
Poetry is a multi-lifetime learning thing. However, it is possible to write a poem in a relatively short period of time. You'll go back to it and back to it, of course. But that's easier than writing a chapter of a novel and maintaining the continuity and the very large shape that you have to have in your head to write a novel. So that's been my prime thing probably for about the last decade. But I have also written nonfiction, and my most recent nonfiction is the book on bibliodiversity, which is a manifesto for the publishing industry. And, yeah, so, I mean, It's difficult to maintain a writing life and be a publisher. But the times when I've managed to write the most are when I've been lucky to take a little bit of time out for a few months and go away and immerse myself in a project. And my collection's Cow, I wrote while I was in India for 4 months on an AsiaLink residency, and the one Lupra and Lamb, which is my most recent poetry collection. I was on a residency in Rome for 6 months. I mean, it was fabulous. And bibliodiversity came out. In fact, each time I've gone away, I've got more than one book out of it. because you just have the time, and, you know, your brain has enough capacity to create into that space, I guess.
And you have Madame Spinifex at home.
Yes.
Which was moi at the time.
Keeping it all together.
Keeping it all together, yes, that was very important. And everybody in the office, you know, was fabulous as well, you know.
Yes, and it introduced so many new systems.
But it wasn't as if I wasn't answering emails and what have you. But I wasn't spending as much of each day doing that sort of work.
I guess it's good to be away from it sometimes.
You do. Everybody needs a sabbatical now and again. Even publishers.
It would have been nice.
And Renata.
Well, I've basically, ever since I started, as I said earlier, being critical of reproductive technologies in the 1980s, when I was one of the editors of the first ever book written by feminists, being mildly critical of IVF, etc., because we didn't really even know what that would mean for women. And so it was three of us starting this book called Test Your Women, What Future for Motherhood? And we were collecting essays that people sent us. And we really honestly started this book saying, we don't really know what we even think about this. And by the time we had amassed all these essays, we thought, my God, this is not good for women, because in the end, you know, they're trying to take over the capacity of women to make babies so that it can be decided not by women in which country, which kind of women are allowed to have what kind of babies. And we're really going down that track. But sadly, in the public eye, I mean, it's so sad to see more and more women thinking, I have to do it, I have to try, I have to get this baby. And IVF is still only less than 20% successful. And that's for so-called good women with good eggs, young women.
And it's expensive too, and such a class thing as well.
Very, very much. So it's really for...
It's not accessed for everyone.
No.
Clearly.
It's really for rich people. And in fact, just yesterday I read an article by some Norwegian scientists who said something we had been saying for years, I said, well, we're having a very big experiment. We actually don't know. It's quite amazing, when an embryo is cultured in a petri dish, round thing, the culture medium makes a huge difference. And it's usually kept secret because that is why some programs have a slightly higher success rate than others. Well, it turns out that not even the people know in those labs know exactly what's in it, because the people who make those culture medias, they keep it a secret.
Right. And so intellectual property and all of that.
These IVF scientists from Norway have expressed great concern that we might, and they actually said it in their words, we might be sitting on a time bomb, because we might have 50-year-old people conceived of IVF who might have all sorts of problems with their health.
Exactly.
And this is not fear-mongering.
And you don't
simply
know,
we don't know
controls over the mechanisms of it, and you don't know black market,
absolutely.
I mean, the cat's out of the bag.
Yes. The eugenic nature of it as well.
Yes, I can choose and select my perfect baby. Yeah. And it's funny how the perfect baby is always a blonde and blue eyed.
Absolutely, that really
Well, it's not funny, but it's, it's obvious.
And it's just so demeaning. So, people used to go, well, they can't anymore, they've stopped that, but they used to go to India for surrogacy, and so the white embryos got put into these Indian women who are obviously not white, and out comes a white baby. And then in these instances when there was something wrong with the baby, they hadn't picked up during all the tests, and so there was a disabled baby being born, and some people didn't want it.
No.
So it's a very scandalous industry.
Bad.
And I just think people have to learn. I mean, I've done a lot of research on infertility, so I really do understand the pain of being infertile, and that is very painful. And society looks down at you, and you're not a proper woman if you don't have your own baby, blah blah,
etc.
And I really know that, but nevertheless, a desire is not a need, and there are so many babies around, children around, who need really good looking after. So I still say, and it's a very unpopular view, well, for heaven's sake, if you say, oh, so want a child in my life, do permanent care, which you can do in Victoria, which is better than adoption, because the child doesn't have to give up all her or his identity.
Yes, yeah, their rights.
Do that.
Yeah.
Get involved. And if you don't want to do that...
Child rights is something too, I think. And in our community, we're seeing a big change and shift with new adoption laws and surrogacy and so on.
Yes.
So it means we have that entitlement.
Yes.
Entitlement isn't always necessarily a good idea.
No, it's
in
not.
In my opinion.
Because with surrogacy, you know, whether it's a gay couple or a heterosexual couple or a single woman or a single man, doesn't matter. It always needs a woman's body, you know, who's used like a breeder. She's used like an oven. She's used like a suitcase. And at the end of 9 months, after she's lived with this child that she actually grows out of her own bones and blood, she gives it away.
Mm.
And because they put an embryo in that doesn't have her genes, you know, the medical industry has been pretty good at sort of brainwashing people to say, oh, this woman doesn't have any attachment to this embryo because it's not got her genes. Well, say that to a pregnant woman who's sick through half her pregnancy.
Mm.
Oh, I'm just sick. I know it's not my genes, but I still have morning sickness. Or, you know, my tummy gets bigger and bigger. I can hardly move. I have no attachment to this product in me.
Do you consider this to be, for our listeners who are listening now, a feminist issue?
Oh, definitely it's a feminist issue.
Everything is a feminist issue.
Yes, but it should also be a humanist issue, because I think it's a human rights violation that what's happening to women. And also, if people don't like that aspect, what about the baby? Has the baby ever been asked if he wants to be given away? I don't think so.
No,
and, you know, we've had in this country, we've had apologies by Julia Gillard, the last one was in 2013, to women who were forced to give their baby away for adoption in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So, and she said, this shall never happen again. And quite frankly, if surrogacy were to continue on a big scale, which I hope it won't in Australia, we'll have to do another apology in 20 years' time, saying, oh, so sorry for all those babies that were taken away from their birth mothers.
Other countries.
Yes.
That's the thing.
Yes.
It's like a womb for rent.
Yes.
Well,
that's exactly what it is.
I find it disturbing, too.
Very disturbing.
Yeah.
But you probably, some of your listeners might not like this, because they might especially say, well, how can two gay men otherwise have their own baby? And to that I just say, have you got sisters? Have you got friends? You know, there's so many, as I said before, there's so many babies in the world. Do you really need to exploit a woman so that you can have your precious little child? It's just like, I want it, I need to get it, you know, I can pay for it.
Yeah, I'm entitled.
I'm entitled. It's very consumer.
And a lot of
logic.
It does come from the privilege that is. So it is very topical right now.
Very topical, very controversial, and you know. Sort of, and you have to cope with the criticism. Mm. And I usually say I have developed a thick skin, and you have to. But I mean, everybody has to do that in life. I think if you speak out about what you believe, then you know you have to. You get criticism. You also get a lot of praise, and you just basically live it.
And we will be talking about these issues at our weekend event on Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, so it starts Friday. Is there a reason it's on a Friday?
Well, we were going to have it on the Saturday and the Sunday, but the venue, which is the Lithuanian Club, is booked by the Fringe Festival from Sunday.
Right. Okay.
So we thought, well, okay, we'll do it Friday and Saturday then. So it starts at... Well, registration is from 1 p.m. on Friday, and the talks and stuff start at 2 p.m. With a welcome to country by Annette Shibaras, and then speakers from the community. So really, Friday afternoon, we opened up to anybody who wanted to put forward a suggestion for a 10-minute talk.
Okay.
Some of the writers in the afternoon session are Spinifex authors, some are not, but they are members of the feminist community, you know.
I noticed the 10 minutes, they're quite bite-sized.
Yeah. Whereas the program on Saturday is more focused on Spinifex authors. And so we will we're covering a huge range of subjects, you know, from stuff on sexual violence against women to autobiography to a session on poetry and fiction writing, and others on health and institutional violence, medical and institutional violence against women. And the opening session on Saturday morning is What's Radical About Radical Feminism?
And well, that brings me to the question, actually. What is it? So, look, no, you were going to answer that, obviously, Renata.
Come along to the session and find out.
Briefly. No, because it is something that, you know, there's been a bit of a, I'll say, a shitstorm about some of the aspects of radical feminism in the last decade, maybe, or last few years, maybe.
30 years.
30 oh, wow, well, okay, 30 years. Yeah. But it's kind of intensified with some, obviously with some people and their views and opinions. But what makes radical feminism, where's the radical bit? What's that?
I think that radical feminism is transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the only version of feminism, or the only feminist philosophy, that looks at the structures of society and changes and ways to change the structure. Whereas, I mean, reformist programs, they are useful. Liberal feminism is useful, but it doesn't change the structure. It's just about getting equality for stars, perhaps. But we know that that doesn't happen anyway. Whereas radical feminism says we have to go to the root of things. We have to really think again about the way society is structured, and we have to transform the social structures and social forms. And that is what makes it very different, I think.
And also, I mean, one of the important words in radical feminism is patriarchy. And patriarchy is actually coming back in use a bit more recently, right, which is very good. But for us, patriarchy is absolutely, you know, the bottom line. And we should also not forget that patriarchy has only been here for 6,000 years, which in the scheme of things, how long the planet has existed, is actually a very short time. So we can overthrow it. And patriarchy, radical feminism has always characterized as being not just sexism, but classism and racism, and, you know, being against disabled, discriminating against disabled people, and you name it. So it's not just that, you know, men discriminate against women on the grounds of sex. It's all the other issues. It's what these days is called intersectional, which we have, which, I mean, sometimes, you know, that comes with being quite old. She says, you just have to just not lose your good humor, because another buzzword comes up, and all you can say is, like, we did that 30 years ago. It wasn't called intersectional then, but that is what radical feminism is. So I think Susan gave a good definition. I would also say that when you say that you're a radical feminism, and that has not changed since the early 70s, you are immediately seen as a witch, a man-hater, an ugly lesbian. And that really hasn't changed. And if I may, just a very quick anecdote. I'm from Switzerland originally, so there I was kind of really, more of an equality feminist. I thought, yeah, well, some things are not right, but they've got nothing to do with me because I have such a good life. I'm so equal. If somebody had said to me, you're oppressed, I would have gotten actually probably quite annoyed. So me, oppressed, never. And so, but somehow or other, it was intriguing, these new ideas. We're talking early 70s, you know, when feminism came along. And there's a woman who started to make a name for herself. Her name is Alice Schwarzer, and she's from Germany. She's a lesbian. She was always out as a lesbian. And she started the magazine later in 77 called Emma, and that still exists. Anyway, she came to Zurich to talk, and she'd written this book. I don't think it was out at the time, which was interviews with 17 women from all walks of life. And she talks about really how women don't pay it enough, you know, that women are oppressed, blah, blah. So she was announced to talk at the student union. And I thought, yep, I'm going to listen to her. And all my friends said, to me, why would you go and listen to her? She's stupid, she's ugly, and she's lesbian.
Oh, and was she angry too?
And
she's angry. Why are you so angry, Sonia?
I have no idea why I actually, you know, went. I can't remember if I went by myself or I had a very good girlfriend at the time. So I think we went together. And Ali Schwartz was charming. She was funny. I thought she was really good looking. And what she was saying made perfect sense to me. And so I came back and said, what's the matter with you all? You don't get it, do you? And in a way, that conversation that I had in around, the book came out in 75, I think it was about 73, that has stayed with me. And that is why radical feminism, you know, has kept this really terrifying aura with it, that what we are saying is so dangerous that they have to shut us down. And that hasn't changed.
And that's come still up the recently same today. Too.
That's come up recently
with the Melbourne Writers Festival and
yes,
Melinda Tankard.
That's right, Reist. Yeah,
Reist.
And we have never published at Spinifex anything that demeans women who are in prostitution or sex work, if you prefer to call it a sex work. We have never done that. What we have done, we have given space to voices of women who have been in the sex industry as prostitutes and who have left. So we published Paid For by Rachel Moran from Ireland, and we've recently published Prostitution Narratives that has 20 accounts of women who've left the sex industry from around the Western world. We thought we can't go into, we want to just talk about women in the Western world. And I think it's really important that the general public hears about some of the negative views that come out of women who were part of the sex industry and have managed to survive. At the same festival event that you mentioned, there was also a book being discussed called Invisible Women by...
The Murdered Women?
Yes.
No. Oh, no?
No,
yes,
no.
Yes, they were. Yes, that women were murdered.
Yes, the murdered women, sorry. 65 women were murdered. Women who've been in sex work were murdered. Now, you know, I think the public has a right to know these statistics. I mean, prostitution is one of the dangerous occupations, if you want to call it that. And women who come out of prostitution have all sorts of health issues, mental health issues. Why they get into prostitution is a whole different question. Many of them, not all, but many of them have been sexually abused as children. Well, why is it not legitimate to talk about both sides of the trade? And they really wanted, I mean, some women in the sex work circles really don't want our women to talk about their experiences. Now, I think that's just wrong. You know, you should hear both sides and you should listen to both sides. And as it was, the session was very friendly, very people listened. There was apparently a protest outside. We didn't see that. It was really good and people learned something.
And if I can sort of give a poetic answer of both the things that Renata's been talking about in terms of prostitution and visibility of lesbians and stuff, two of my poetry books, the first, an earlier one, Cow, I wrote in India. And what is interesting about that is that I can read poems about cows. So I have one called Anactoria Says to Sappho. So clearly it's a lesbian poem just by the title. But I have read that poem to farmers, and they get it because cows sidle up to one another and make, a very affectionate amongst themselves. So if you talk about cows and you write poems from the point of view of a cow, you can say anything, you can do anything, you know. So, and you know, the main character in this book is called Queenie, and the word queen comes from the Sanskrit word for cow, because back in the old days, not now really, queens were women who had a lot of cows, you know, and if you didn't have a cow, well, you know, you were
cattle
really,
and exchange and property.
So it was, and getting inside, I grew up on a farm, and so, you know, cows and animals and, you know, all sorts of different animals are very close to my psyche in lots of ways. So, but being able to walk through a sort of poetic universe as a cow. You know, you can do it anywhere. And then the other one...
And the book got shortlisted for quite a prestigious prize in Australia. Obviously, they just read about cows and not lesbians.
The Kenneth Slessor Poetry Award and also the Audre Lorde Lesbian Poetry Prize in the States. So that was nice. And my later book, Looper and Lamb, picks up on the prostitution theme because the word looper in Latin is the word both for wolf and for prostitute. And so I start that book with stories about the founding of Rome. And frankly, you know, the founding of Rome was a violation of women and an oppression of animals and a series of rapes different kinds of prostitution that were practiced and so on. So, I mean, there are other ways of talking about these same issues, and then the lamb is the virgin martyrs, who I became really fascinated by, and these were mostly young girls of 13 to 15, you know, who were raped and tortured and pulled through the streets, but some of them really got their own back, like, you know, touching them meant the men became impotent, or they started growing hair all over their bodies, or they couldn't be easily killed, and you know, things like that. So there are stories like that about the different ways that women have resisted patriarchy. So but it goes all through the history of Rome are these series of different kinds of violations, but also different kinds of resistances that were played out.
And I guess that's the thing too. Perhaps people can understand the radical side of feminism because it's the resistance. Mm. And it's a bit like people are bandying around the word queer a lot. I use it a lot to just because it fits so many of the things that I'm interested in and what I think about, and because it's also... Originally, it's also about the reclaiming that word and resistance, and the resistance to the heteronormative landscape that we all have to exist in, pretty much. And perhaps the word radical is the same too.
And the word lesbian needs to be reinvented and reused now because lesbians are being completely sidelined in all sorts of different ways.
So invisible
all
now.
All sorts of different ways, and you know they can just be completely left off. I've done research on the torture of lesbians internationally, and nearly all of the research is being done on gay men, trans people, and a little tiny corner about lesbians, even on research that is specifically meant to deal with that. Occasionally also there might be research on women, and then the torture of lesbians is usually a footnote or an appendix or something like that. So, you know, in both instances, in both groups, lesbians are really sidelined.
Obviously we're running out of time, but can you see why is it so, is it this way?
Well, some of it is because it's hard to find lesbians because lesbians are not out there. But also I've battled with Amnesty International over a number of years to write an article for their magazine. At one stage back in the early 2000s, it looked as if it would happen, and then it didn't happen. And basically I think it didn't happen because nobody wants to fight for lesbians.
Why?
Specifically because it's bad publicity.
Because
it won't get them money. It won't get donations. Nobody will donate, really, to a fight for lesbian. There have been a few in the last few years, like Ronnie Apata from Uganda, and some of those activists have managed.
And we know about South Africa.
And we know about the corrective rates rapes in South Africa. But that was very slow to come out. And I'd been writing about it for about 5 years before that started to come out. And there's still rarely a program on TV about lesbians, and lesbians get raped by men.
They die horribly.
Hashtag
another dead lesbian in a lot of films. Even in a recent film that won awards and is being, promoted around the place an Australian film called Bad Girl, and I gave it a bad review because, yeah, hashtag another dead lesbian. I'm right, just yeah, spoiled yeah, the film yeah, for you, but yeah. I'm not spoiling it really. But in my opinion, it was, yeah, it's very difficult to find those fictional stories that represent lesbians in a positive way, or just an like just a way can we survive, you know? Instead well, of the story where we all die or get killed or murdered or something awful, can we just survive?
I think also it's very difficult for lesbians to migrate from some countries without travelling with a man.
Okay.
And so when a woman comes to a country and she's travelling with a man, there is an assumption that they are in a relationship together. They may be, they might not be. But it's also possible that the woman might be a lesbian and the man she's travelling with might not know that she's a lesbian. You know, so there are lots of problems of actually what they call discoverability, actually finding lesbians, because lesbians live often in such restrictive environments and they don't have their own possibility to do things
so
on their
a
own.
Lot of this too, yes. So in the global community or global connections, there's that problem, I guess. It comes back to ownership and property and women as property and ownership and not fulfilling their own lives as such. Yeah, it's a difficult one. You've made it clearer for me of why we have this problem all these
really
years later.
I think being lesbian is the ultimate threat to patriarchy because it actually means that two women can have a really happy, healthy, wonderful life together and they don't need a man. And I think some men still see that as a total insult, and which I think is
because
really
it's not
2016.
It's not for them.
Well,
it might be on some sites, blah blah, on some porn sites, but it's not for them.
No,
ultimately.
Yeah,
and maybe we're going to have to leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Can I say that the program begins at 2 p.m. on Friday, and Friday afternoon, we've got a whole lot of talks happening. We've got a launch of our catalogue happening, and then we've got an evening performance.
Yeah, I see that. From 6 p.m?
From 6 p.m, with which is being...
Where is that going to be held?
Same place,
same
the
venue.
Lithuanian Club, which is in Errol Street, North Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And Sue Ingleton, who is a fabulous comedian, is emceeing that. And we've got Kavisha Matella.
Oh, cool.
And we've got singers and poets and all sorts of wonderful the Dyke Divas Choir. And Annie Pratton, who's a Bundjalung woman from northern New South Wales, is coming, and Danny Towney from Queensland is coming. She's a fabulous singer, and you know, we've got great things.
Really also thank the Victorian Women's Trust, who gave us a small sum of money which saved us from having to do crowdfunding. We're very grateful to Mary Crooks from the Victorian Women's Trust.
Yes, she's fabulous.
Yes, she's a very wonderful woman, and we really thank her for that.
And that
she
meant
saved
we could
us.
Get the venue, you know, which was as a real plus.
Part of the venue.
Part of the venue, yes.
And then, of course, it continues on Saturday, the 10th of September, from 9:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m.
Yes, and at the end, at 4 o'clock, we always at the end of a Radical Feminist Conference, you write the Feminist Manifesto for the future, and so we're going to do that and see what happens.
Excellent. Well, and what a weekend.
There'll be lots of, you know, there's a chance to sit around in the bar and have a drink.
Talk.
Or there's lots of eating places around North Melbourne. So hopefully they finish the tram works by the weekend.
And, of course, on the website, can people go there to find out more, or where do they
go? Well, it's basically the same information that's on our website.
Yep.
So they can go to our website and look at the program there. And also on Facebook, we've got the same program, that's the first item on our Facebook page, and if you'd like us and friend us,
so
then
just
we'd love to hear from you.
Press on Facebook, SpinFX
Press. SpinFX Press will come up, and the same if you put in SpinFX Press into Google, our website will come up, and the program is just underneath the new releases. So you just scroll down and you can see the
full program.
We've
got a very vibrant Facebook, actually. It's like a news site, like a feminist news site. So people might be interested in just looking at that.
That'll be great. Yeah. We'll keep in touch, and certainly good luck with That's Radical Feminism, a celebration of SpinFX 25 years. And so thank you so much. What a great talk. Could have kept going.
Thank you, Sonia.
Thanks, Renata Klein and Susan Hawthorne. And good luck with the weekend and the future.
Thank you. It's been great.
And smash the patriarchy.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune in to us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy. For feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.